Muslim marries Christian, Christian marries Jew. What are the issues that require navigation in an interfaith marriage? And how does one navigate them? We'll find out on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes. As always, those are my babies. Thanks for getting Daddy started today. Mwah. Author Naomi Schaefer Riley is with us today. And I'm curious, what are some of the challenges interfaith couples face?
Well, they face a lot of the same challenges that every couple faces. If you talk to marriage counselors, if you talk to religious leaders, they'll say that the things that couples tend to fight about, that they tend to have tension about in their relationships, are how to spend your time, how to spend your money, and how to raise your children. And faith, of course, affects all of those things. Everything from whether you want to go to church on Sunday or synagogue on Saturday, whether you want to attend mosque on Friday, how much you want to contribute monetarily to your religious community, how you want to answer your children's questions about life and death. All of these things might produce different answers in an interfaith couple. And so I think the challenges are really kind of on a day-to-day basis working through those issues.
And how do interfaith couples raise their children? What are some of the ways that that issue or that dynamic is navigated?
Well, the interfaith couples raise their children in all sorts of ways. They're more often adopt the faith of the mother than the faith of the father. Many interfaith couples choose to raise their children with no faith at all. Mm-hmm. And some sort of don't choose that but kind of fall into that because it becomes very difficult to navigate. And so both the husband and the wife kind of adopt a more hands-off attitude, and the result is that the children are raised with no faith.
It is. Now, do the children are raised with no faith, does that mean, well,
is there any blowback from that?
And I was thinking that you were going to say the children are raised to select the faith that they want, but that's not what you said. So, I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah. So, well, it's both. I mean, there are some families where I did both a nationally representative survey, and I did interviews also with people in interfaith couples, and you know, some people said, you know, we want the children to choose for themselves, and they were sort of trying to provide their children with a basis in each faith to kind of be able to make that decision. But there were other cases in which it was such a fraught topic that neither person felt like they could actually share their faith with their children in a way that wasn't going to hurt the other person in the couple. And I think most worrisome in some ways is that a lot of couples I talked to didn't even really discuss this before they got married.
Or had children.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm. And the faith of the mother being adopted, have you noticed that in when the combination is of all religions, I mean, or any religion, so it's not just if the mom is Muslim or it's not just if the mom is Christian, it's that happens a lot?
Across the religious spectrum, children are more than twice as likely to have the faith of their mother as the faith of their father. And I think part of that is the way religion works in America. Mothers tend to be the one not only who create rituals at home, they also tend to be the ones who are more present in the pews on Sundays. Mm-hmm. They tend to be the ones who are driving children to and from any kind of religious education they experience. And so as a result, they exert a lot more influence in this way.
Mm. Mm.
They're the ones calling on the name of God and dealing with the children on a regular basis. So the kids are like, who are you talking to, Mom?
What are some of the, I've mentioned three of the major religions, but there's certainly more. So I've mentioned Islam, Christianity, Judaism, but there's Buddhism, there's Taoism.
Yeah.
I think Taoism is a major, would it be considered one of the major religions, even though it's not in this United States? Yeah.
Sure. So for my research, I looked mostly at the three you mentioned, at Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. But I also interviewed some couples who were Hindu and Christian. I think with the Buddhist and some of the other Eastern religions, it's a little bit hard to quantify. Some of those folks actually, at least in the U.S., practice Buddhism as well as other religions, mm-hmm. and they also don't see religion as kind of an exclusive thing as much as maybe the other three major Abrahamic religions that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But I interviewed, you know, Mormons who are married to Jehovah's Witnesses. Even within Christianity, of course, there is a huge range of beliefs and a huge range of practices that families do have to navigate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show for you, my brethren, who, like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and the information that'll help create loving and flexible parents and partners. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us, and then via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get the show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please give us a favorable iTunes rating, and please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We are always looking for the new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my super-duper co-host, Nancy Goldring.
Hi, Frank.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. The consummate generalist.
Indeed.
Yes, yes. I recently read in the last decade that 45% of all marriages in the U.S. were between people of different faiths. And this week's guest has a particular interest in that statistic. She's a weekly columnist for the New York Post, a former Wall Street Journal editor and writer whose work focuses on religion and culture, among other things. Her writings have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the LA Times, as well as the Washington Post, among other publications. She also appears regularly on Fox News and Fox Business and CNBC. She is Naomi Schaefer Riley. So, if you, like me, want to know if people who enter interfaith marriages are not just religious to begin with, meaning they're not into religion that much, if interfaith marriages are more or less stable than the same faith marriages, and which religious communities are most hospitable to interfaith couples, then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks with the author of a New York Times Book Review editor's pick, Till Faith Do Us Part, How Interfaith Marriage is Transforming America. Again, Naomi Schaefer Riley. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Before we get too deep into today's subject matter, I want to check in to see what's going on in the news. And Ms. Riley, please don't be Mrs. Riley, please don't be bashful. We certainly want your thoughts, too.
I appreciate that.
All right. Five ways to spot passive-aggressive behavior. That certainly is a topic that shows up in relationships, or a dynamic that shows up in relationships.
Yes.
I'm reaching here. Were you aggressive-aggressive or passive-aggressive?
I'm aggressive-aggressive.
Okay.
If I'm, well, you know what? Maybe I should say that differently. I'm aggressive-aggressive if I feel comfortable in the relationship.
Mm. Okay.
If I don't feel fully self-expressed,
mm-hmm.
then I definitely can tend to be passive-aggressive, yes.
Mm. Mm.
Yes.
Mrs. Riley, you want to weigh in there?
I want to know what the five ways are to spot the passive-aggressive behavior.
So before she starts giving anything away.
Before I get to that, I probably am aggressive.
No.
I try to check it. I try to check, you know, because I think we could be both.
Yes.
I can see places where, in what I'm about to say, I can see things that I've done, yet I try to check myself. I really do. Passive aggressiveness is not something that I
pride yourself
yeah,
on. Right.
It really yeah. isn't. Okay, here we go. The silent treatment.
No.
That's not you.
No.
Hmm.
No. I may be silent about an issue, but I'm not giving you the silent treatment. I don't go for the silent treatment. If you give me the silent treatment, it's on you.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation's over. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I have too much to say to go with the silent treatment.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So. Okay. Subtle insults.
Like sarcasm?
I think that can definitely be considered a subtle insult.
Well, you know, I heard once someone say that sarcasm is anger's ugly cousin.
I agree.
And before I heard that, I considered dry, biting, sarcastic humor funny.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started to shift my perspective and consider that it was actually an attack on the person, then I began to check it in myself, because it was not something that I thought was at all problematic. I just thought it was another style of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I agree. And my parents actually were very, they always warned me against being too sarcastic. They were always, and I always thought it was hilarious. And you can get people to laugh.
Right.
Yeah.
But you are, it can be very hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I would say if you're going to be sarcastic, try to be sarcastic about yourself. No, you know, make
yeah,
the joke about
yeah,
you.
Yeah, about you. Yes, mm-hmm. yes, I agree. Yeah. I agree.
Sullen behavior. And I have seen this. I've seen it's where I think it's where people are acting down or miserable in an effort to get attention. That's my
get
interpretation.
You to feel sorry for them, yeah, feels, or get concerned.
Or come
oh
to
goodness.
Where they are.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't expect too much of the interaction.
That's work.
That is work. And it can be depressing to be around
that's
people
right
like
up
that.
There with the silent treatment. If you need too much work, I'm going to leave you to a professional.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't do all that work.
What do you think to our guest?
Oh, yes. No, I think that's right in there with the silent treatment. I think, I don't like it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I engage in it very much, but I don't like it.
Stubbornness. And do you see any of these in your children? So is it not just in your relationship? And you have children, don't you?
Yes, I do. I have three kids.
I have five.
Zero.
Uh-huh.
So no, I don't see it in my children.
Mm-hmm. The sullenness, and that's sort of probably what bothers me about it in adults, is that it's very childish.
Mm-hmm.
It's
and
manipulative.
So you see, like my 4-year old will cross her arms and make that face, and it's not attractive in adults. It's sort of adorable in a 4-year old.
Right.
Yeah.
Time. Right.
Yeah. Stubbornness.
Stubbornness. Is that passive aggressive?
I see how it can be. To basically be so strong-willed as to be, I think the silent treatment can be a form of being stubborn.
No.
Is that, you don't think?
No, that's on a whole other page. To me, a person that's stubborn is essentially sort of gotten entrenched in their own point of view, and they're not willing to change.
Hard-nosed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And often to me, that's a trigger, not a trigger, but an opportunity to get creative.
Mm-hmm.
If the person is saying, no, we're going to do it this way or something like that. Now, it can be, now Naomi, tell me if you're with me on this one. Sometimes you can, how do I want to get that? I had it just a second ago. So the person is stubborn. Sometimes going along with them is an act of passive aggression. So it's like you know that they shouldn't go a particular way. No, I'm telling you, we're going to go this way. We're going to do this. no, don't turn left. Mm-hmm. They, no, we're turning left. I know where I'm going. And they turn left, and there's a big old sign there that says road closed. Well, you saw it last night. Mm-hmm. So you said, okay, baby.
Do what you do. Rock and roll. Do
what you got. So maybe that.
Find whatever you want.
Right, right. Or, you know, doing exactly what you're told. I know they say at work there are people who you give them a directive, and how they act it out in a passive aggressive nature is to do exactly what you told them to do, when maybe the situation required or called for them to maybe act a bit intuitively, mm-hmm. that
exercise
something else
a little more judgment.
Right. Yeah. Something else would have been appropriate, but they did exactly what you said. And that's a form of passive aggression also.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
And failure to finish required task.
Hmm.
Like, you know, my son, well, I mean, we're talking about relationship. Well, I've mentioned children, too. I asked my son to take the trash out, and he only takes one bag. I mean, it's two trash cans, but he only takes one out. And then
he left one for you, Poppy.
It's almost like a need for me to say something else, for me to have to come back and check and then say, why didn't you do this? It's a way to get additional attention. To say, what's going on? Why would you overlook this? Does that make
failure to finish a required task?
And that could be passive aggressive by way of, instead of saying,
I don't want to do it.
I don't want to do it, or I want your attention. Can I get your attention in some form, positive way? You are asking for my attention by doing something you know I don't want you to do, and you know I'm going to correct you on or say something about.
I see.
I think with the right look and the right tone of voice, you can be passive aggressive doing anything.
Yeah.
That's the lesson, I think, from these five.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Multifaceted way of being.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, Miss Riley, let's get to the good stuff. If people who enter interfaith marriages are not, well, are they? People who are of different faiths and they get married, are they just typically people who are not that into religion in the first place?
You know, surprisingly, I found that was not the case. So, like I said, I did this nationally representative survey of 2,500 Americans, and I asked questions like, you know, when you were a child, did you go to religious services growing up regularly? Did you attend Sunday school? How would you characterize the religiosity of your family? You know, were you very religious in your house? And I found that there was actually no difference between people who entered interfaith marriages and people who were in same-faith marriages based on those questions. There was really nothing in your childhood or even in your adolescence that would have predicted you would not care about religion and therefore you would enter a marriage with somebody of another religion. The one thing that I found that was really correlated, you know, the strongest predictor of whether you would be in an interfaith relationship was the age at which you got married. The older you are when you get married, the more likely you are to marry someone of another religion.
You become more tolerant?
Well, I kind of like experimented with a bunch of different theories about this. And, you know, I don't know, you know, as you probably know, Americans are getting married older and older. You know, now the average age of first marriage for women is 27, for men it's 29, which is just historically unheard of. I mean, if you look at not only American history, but kind of world history, you know, people never got married that late. And I think what's happened is that these years of your 20s, you know, what they call emerging adulthood now, tend to be a time where we're really not very religious. We're very transient. We're moving around a lot, different jobs, different homes, different roommates, boyfriends, girlfriends. And I think one of the things that happens is that we're not in the habits, the religious habits. We're not regularly attending church or synagogue. We're not, you know, performing the kind of weekly rituals that you might perform when you were living with your parents. And so by the time you meet someone, you know, at the age of 28 or something like that, you don't seem like a religious person. Mm-hmm. I mean, that may be something that you have in mind for your future, and it may be an important part of your past, but at that moment in time, you know, you're a pretty secular person in that way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not that we're misrepresenting ourselves to future, you know, future husbands and wives. It's just, you know, you meet that person at a time in their lives, and religion kind of ebbs and flows in our life. And I think we're meeting our mates now at a time where we're at our least religious.
It's interesting that you say that. When I got married the first time when I was 27, and I was probably much more, I won't say religious, but I'd say more dogmatic then than I was when I was married the second time. And the thing for me wasn't so much religion. The religion has always been the same, but it's the dogma. It's the interest and willingness to want it my way so much that I think made the difference. What are your thoughts on the hard nose approach and the dogma that comes with religion often, and how it becomes a part of this conversation?
Yeah, sure. As you get older, you know, and have more life experiences, I think there are people who, you know, tend to, you know, maybe it's being more tolerant, maybe it's being less dogmatic, and maybe it's just that you've met a wider range of people and you're a little less sheltered than you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's interesting because one of the things that happens after people get into these marriages is that they also find that religion is something they want to come back to. Not necessarily the dogma, but, you know, especially with raising kids, you know, a lot of people, you know, the first thing they think of is that I should do what my parents did, or mm-hmm. I should, you know, all of these, you know, rituals, whether it's, you know, a baptism or a bar mitzvah or mm-hmm. all these things that you have these deep memories of as a child, you want to recreate for your family in many cases. And
both partners want that.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. And maybe they want different things. But it's also all these other life events. I mean, you know, as you get older and you're, you know, maybe your parent passes away, you know, you're sort of drawn back into, you know, these deep questions about faith and about ritual. And I think that often surprises, in an interfaith marriage, that can often surprise a partner because they thought, oh, well, I thought you'd left all that stuff behind and you didn't really care about that, you know, but here you are, you know, you want to have, you know, your parent dies, and sometimes people are really drawn very much back into their religious community for support when something like that happens.
Mm-hmm. I have seen couples where where one person was never that into whatever the religion is that they grew up in, and they pretty much did what the other partner did. But when they got divorced, that person who was never much into what they did goes back to the religion they grew up in and becomes more immersed in it. It seems like it could be a reaction almost to the divorce. Have you seen anything like that or heard of anything like that?
Well, I mean, I've certainly talked to people who are in interfaith marriages and who got divorced. I think, you know, one of the dynamics that may be at work there is you have somebody who was, you know, people when they, you know, are in a difficult marriage often say they sort of lost themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can imagine the dynamic how when they get out of a relationship, they want to sort of go back and find their own foundations and their own roots.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do go back and try to find that. And I think, you know, that might be very good for them as a person, mm-hmm. but it can also be very difficult for children in those marriages.
Yeah.
You have, you know, suddenly a situation where children are being pulled in two different directions religiously. I mean, you know, I talked to family judges who were having to make decisions about how children should be raised religiously, which is, of course, something that our country's laws do not want to get into.
Right.
But when you have these two parents who are fighting over, you know, whether I should be able to take my kids to church, even though they've been raised Jewish up until this point, it can be very hurtful.
Mm-hmm. the couple I'm thinking about, the person that wasn't that into the religion they came up with, they weren't even going to those type services. Of services when they were dating. Mm-hmm, was not even, it wasn't even directly related to the marriage. It was even predating the marriage and even predating the relationships. You know, it's just interesting. Are you in a faith marriage?
So I'm in a faith, no faith marriage, which is, I think, not uncommon these days. I mean, my I grew up Jewish, and my husband grew up a Jehovah's Witness, actually, and he had left the faith long before I met him. But I think it sort of, even, you know, sort of just shapes your understanding of religion. And it certainly, and this is one of the factors that always comes up in interfaith relationships, even if the two partners sort of are in agreement or, you know, sort of in harmony. You know, I told my husband I wanted to raise my children Jewish on our first date. But, you know, I think then you have the whole question of extended family, you know, and I mean, I think it's kind of become a joke in our culture in some ways. You have the, you know, my big fat Greek wedding kind of dynamic going on where you have people from such disparate backgrounds, you know, getting together. And it's, you know, one of the great things about our country that you can have that. But I also think, you know, there are definitely ways in which people who are entering interfaith marriages just, they think about marriage as the union of two individuals. Because that's kind of our modern way of thinking about marriage. But there's really a lot more going on, and you come from a family, and you come from a community, and how are you going to navigate those questions and those compromises?
How did he respond to that? I want to raise my kids Jewish when I get married.
Well,
on the first date.
We had known each other for a while by that point. I think he was surprised that I said that, because he thought that the bigger issue for us was going to be the fact that I'm white and he's black. But for me, the issue all along had just been a matter of religion. And I talk about this in my book in part because I think that too many couples wait too long to have this conversation. I found in my survey that more than half of people in interfaith relationships don't talk about how they want to raise their children before they get married. And I have certainly witnessed personally a lot of couples where they've dated for a long time and each one thought that the other one was going to compromise. And you're getting, you know, a year or two into the relationship, and then people feel like, do I want to throw all that away because of religion, which doesn't maybe seem to me to be the most important thing now, but it becomes a much harder conversation to have, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years into the relationship than it is on the first date, even if you sound a little wacky bringing it up on the first date.
Right. So he didn't convert. He just stopped practicing.
He wasn't practicing.
Right.
Well, that's different, though, in her community.
No, but he didn't convert to Judaism. And I think, you know, one of the, you know, this obviously comes up, too, in the particulars of the religion. In Judaism, you know, if your mother is Jewish, you're Jewish, you know, sort of religiously speaking.
Right.
And, but, you know, that varies. In Islam, if your father is Jewish, if your father is Muslim, then you're Muslim. But in cases where that's not the case, then the children have to go through a kind of conversion process. And that might, you know, make people uncomfortable as well. So I think, you know, from my perspective, the more you talk about this, and, you know, there are all these marriage counseling programs that are out there. And it's funny, but I think the more detail that you can go into before you actually tie the knot, the more you can kind of try to imagine what life is going to be like on the other side, the better off you are.
Did you do a written agreement of any sort around this?
No.
And your situation is, you know, for a black male, I would kind of think that to not be in practicing in a particular religion is almost like a religion of itself. But you had to deal with what you're calling a non-faith faith relationship as well as a interracial relationship. So what were some of those dynamics that were unique to your situation?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people have asked me to kind of compare, you know, what's the difference between an interfaith and interracial relationship. And I think you get, you know, there's some of the the cultural questions there that you get, and some of the just kind of differences of being from different communities and different families. Mm-hmm. But I actually think the interfaith aspect is much more difficult because, like I said, I think it really does affect these three fundamental questions that we were talking about at the beginning, which is, you know, how you want to spend your time as a family, how you want to spend your financial resources, and how you want to raise your children. And I think that, you know, the questions of, you know, how to answer these big questions about life and death and relationships and family. And, I mean, religion has so much to say about those things. And I think, you know, you could say that people from different racial backgrounds might have opinions about those things, but I don't think that there's any kind of centralized understanding of exactly how a white person would answer those or exactly how a black person would answer those. Mm-hmm. So I actually think that the interfaith dynamic is the one that kind of sneaks up on people. I think that they assume that because we, you know, we live in this great tolerant society where interfaith relationships are becoming much more common, and you know, of course we like people of other faiths, and that feels very easy to us. But I think that once you get really deep into the relationship, you know, it becomes much more complicated, especially with children.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned to you earlier that I had read an author who brought up the whole interfaith dynamic, and she says oftentimes what we don't realize is that our faith is a power base. She referred to it as a power base. Mm-hmm. And she says, so when you go to resolve an issue and your wife, you're Catholic and your wife is Buddhist and thinks everything is an illusion, mm-hmm. you got a bigger problem. because mm-hmm. where she's coming from and how to manage a particular issue versus where you're coming from is night and day. And my takeaway from what she was saying was that marrying interfaith marriage was a much bigger deal than we often mm-hmm. think it is. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, how your mate will deal with you mm-hmm. in a crisis or whatever boils down to where they're drawing that power from, that spiritual power from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that power could very well be in, and especially in a situation you noted in terms of Buddhism, it could be in, she may understand or believe that his interest in holding tightly to Catholicism and all of its principles and tenets and that sort of thing is also an illusion, and not worry about it and just say,
but
you
if
know,
you're taking it very seriously,
yeah.
then,
or,
you know.
But if you're taking it seriously and being dogmatic about it, that's different than
that
taking
is.
It seriously.
Yes, yes.
But I think you have to have, you really do have to have an understanding. We have a very superficial understanding of how people in different faiths kind of, we get along with each other. I mean, I try to emphasize to people that, you know, I'm not suggesting that interfaith marriage problems are a sign of intolerance. But I think that somehow our understandings of tolerance have actually gotten into our marriages in a way that's somewhat problematic, mm-hmm. which is to say, you know, I talk to people who would say, well, you know, look, I'm not sure I want to say, even though I'm serious about, you know, being a Baptist or even though I'm serious about being Jewish, should I say that I only want to date other Baptists or Jews, even though that's how I know I want to raise my children? Doesn't that sound bigoted? And people would say that to me. And I would say, I don't think it's the same thing as living next door to someone or being close friends with someone of another faith. When you are married to someone of another faith, you are engaged in this joint project of raising children that requires much more than tolerance of another person's beliefs. It actually requires you to be, sort of be this active participant and engaged in this constant compromise. And I think that is an entirely different, you know, set of skills and set of requirements than just, you know, being a good person and a good friend and a good, you know, member in your community when it concerns people of another faith. And we've kind of lost that distinction, and that worries me a little bit, that people are sort of saying, I can't make this decision, including religion. I talked to, you know, this one pastor who you know, we were kind of discussing this question, and he said, you know, he advises young people in his congregation, you know, about marriage. And he says, look, you know, you need to come up with your list of non-negotiables. You know, these are the things that are deeply important to you. And one of those things could be, I want to marry someone of another faith. And there's nothing of the same faith. And there's nothing wrong with saying that. But unfortunately, I think people, you know, sometimes just, like you said, don't necessarily think that that's going to be a challenge or that that's the most important factor. And so it gets somehow, it doesn't make that list of non-negotiables.
Well, we're trying to play down, I feel, as a society, the religious values, what we believe, what we don't believe. We don't want to, oftentimes it seems that we don't want to seem
intolerant,
controlled,
yeah,
or even controlled by a religion ourselves. We want to feel like these free-thinking beings that aren't necessarily, you know, we may practice a faith, our family may acknowledge a faith, we may acknowledge certain.
Some of us want to present that way, not everybody.
No. Not like universal. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking that then when a deep situation happens, I don't know. I'm kind of caught right now in another issue of what do you do when you're someone spiritual and the person's an atheist? Like, what happens to the religious in the marriage with the one person's religious and the other one doesn't believe in God at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, like I said, a lot of these questions are really become much more important when children are in the relationship.
Right.
Because I think that, you know, really, a couple with no children, I think, you know, can each go off and practice their own religious faith, you know, without a great deal of conflict. I mean, you go here on Saturday, you go here on Sunday. You know, it's not it doesn't need to be as much of a joint project, I guess, as doing so with children does. So, but that being said, I think that, you know, the question of, you know, having someone who's an atheist versus somebody who's a believer, the things that, you know, people tend to argue about, and I asked this question in my survey, how often do you argue with your partner? And I found that there was really not much difference, you know, in terms of how often people argued about religion with people in their faith and people who are not in their faith. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But I wonder whether people sort of mistook the question, which is to say, they thought I was asking, like, how often do you argue about, you know, the divinity of Jesus, or how often do you argue about, you know, whether, you know, both the Old and the New Testament are, you know, equally valid, or, you know, these kind of much more theoretical questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what people are actually having tension over and are actually arguing about are these day-to-day questions. You know, how will we celebrate the holidays? Whose family will we go visit? You know, will our children go to a religious summer camp? Will they attend, you know, catechism classes? Those are the kinds of day-to-day questions that I think present the most challenges. It's not, you know, one husband saying, I believe in God, and a wife saying, I don't, and then having a fight over that every day.
Mm-hmm. I got a quick issue I want to throw out there. A recent experience. It is so steeped in basically ignorance, my own. One of my sons goes to a school with, and there are a lot of Jewish students at this school, and the mom that reached out to me is Jewish. The son is Jewish. And they invited us to a bar mitzvah. I think it's a bar mitzvah. What I'm about to get at is the bar, B-A-R or B-A-T.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a black guy. I grew up in black D.C., I don't know the ins and outs of Judaism. I'm completely ignorant around the difference between a BAT mitzvah and a BAR mitzvah. When I got that invitation, not only did I not know what one was versus the other, I also didn't know what the attire should be. Mm. You know, I felt completely like I need education. And she, I let mom know that I didn't know these things. Please educate me. And she's a writer. You may know her, but she's a writer. And she gave me a whole rundown on the difference. One's for boys, one's for girls. The attire that's appropriate. That and she basically said it. You know, slack khakis and a shirt for the my son. And then there's a party in the evening or something like that.
Right.
I mean, I had no idea of any of this. So I'm kind of just pointing to the ignorance that can exist in communities when you just haven't been exposed.
The traditions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. No, I think that that's often true. But one of the sort of nice things I think now is that we actually live in this much more open, tolerant society where, you know, people who are of other faiths, even if it weren't an event like this, you know, you would be welcome to go visit, you know, a synagogue or a church, you know, of another sect or a mosque. And for the most part, I think in most of these American religious institutions, you would be welcomed in and people would want you to learn. Whereas I think if you had the same experience, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, I think if you walked into a religious institution that was clearly not your own, I think people would wonder what you were doing there. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, now we, you know, not only can you be educated by other people in your community, and your kids are obviously being exposed to other religious beliefs and communities, you know, and this is sort of, I think, one of the causes of this rise in interfaith marriage that you're seeing. Your children are meeting, you know, children from other communities, and the people that we tend to marry are the people that we go to school with, the people that we live near, the people that we work with. It's, you know, marriage is in large part a question of opportunity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why I think you're seeing this big surge. There's a lot more mixing going on than there was, you know, 50 or 60 years ago.
How'd this get to be an interest of yours?
Well, partly it was personal, but partly I've written about religion for a long time. I wrote a book about religious colleges, and I've visited a lot of different faith communities, and I'm just you know, I'm very curious about religion in America. I've thought a lot about kind of how religious organizations, you know, contribute to our kind of our civic life, and you know, all these kind of questions combine to make me want to explore this topic more.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any tips? I'm gonna ask you for two sets of tips. One
Sure.
is how to enter an interfaith marriage, and the other is raising how to raise children within an interfaith marriage. So you can pick whichever one you want to start with.
So the first one I think is easier, I think, because you want to, like I said, I think you want to start this conversation before the marriage. I really, as early as possible, and I think that pastor's advice that I mentioned is very important, this whole idea of knowing your non-negotiables, because you have to know yourself before you know, you know, who you're going to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a lot of religious organizations have this great premarital counseling. The Catholic Church has a very extensive premarital counseling survey where they, you know, you fill out hundreds of questions, and so does your future spouse. Everything from how you spend money to how you want to raise your kids to, you know, which holidays are important to you. And then you compare the answers, and so you can really see where the points of agreement and disagreement are. So I think that those things are hugely helpful. The more you find out before you get married, the better off you are. In terms of raising kids, you know, I talked to people who raised in one faith or no faith. I did talk to people who raised in two faiths.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that, you know, in general, there seemed to be confusion. I can't say this, you know, I didn't do a survey on the kids of interfaith marriages, so I can't say this from a statistical perspective, but I did go visit some communities that have even popped up to kind of try to offer kids an education in both faiths. And the kids I talked to, especially the younger ones, seemed sort of confused about a lot of the background that they were getting. And I think that, you know, in some of the relationships, you see a lot of tit for tat going on. Well, we did this, and now we have to do this. So we did this for you, and now we have to do this for me. And I think that it becomes difficult as a joint project. The other thing that I noticed in the survey is that the older children were, the less likely they were to be raised in two faiths, which I think tells you just on a practical level that it's a difficult project. You know, as kids get older and they have more commitments of all sorts of things, they're not going to want to go to two different religious services every week. They're not going to want to be part of two different religious communities, and they're going to start to have opinions of their own. So it's fine to say, like, I have a two-year-old who I'm exposing to both Judaism and Christianity, but it's a little harder to say that about your 14-year-old.
Right. It's enough to get them to go at all.
Yeah.
You know, I had a knew of a couple, and they were Jewish and raised their children Jewish. However, at holiday time, they acknowledged Christmas. And it was, at least my take on it, was that Christmas was so a part of the cultural fabric that instead of trying to raise their kids around that holiday, they just embraced it. So, you know, you have something here about sharing values and, you know, can you share the same values? How important? Or is sharing the same values the same? It's not the same as practicing the same religion, but...
Right. I think, you know, a lot of people, when I press them on this question of shared values, I think, you know, you wouldn't be surprised at the answers. They were largely, you know, treating other people with respect,
right,
or, you know, treating others as you would want to be treated, or, you know, doing volunteer work or service, or, you know, helping those who are less fortunate. I think that those are obviously things that most of the major religions have in common. But like I said, I think that the tensions in these interfaith families happen much more in the nitty-gritty of exactly how you're going to celebrate, exactly what you're going to tell your children about life and death and those kinds of things. They're not questions. It's not like one person is saying, no, I don't think we need to help those who are less fortunate than us, and the other person is saying, no, we do. So I think the shared values is almost something that those values anyway that people can kind of take for granted, but then they have to ask some harder questions about where the areas of disagreement are.
What do you think about my position on the following? And it's basically religion. I don't want to, religion doesn't have to matter. I'm not going to say it doesn't matter.
Okay.
But it doesn't have to matter. It's more so how you interact with your partner, how you demonstrate communication, how you demonstrate love, how you demonstrate just a genuine connection and caring for one another and what each other cares about, believes, does, that sort of thing. Naomi, what do you say to what I said?
I'm not trying to suggest that religion has to matter to everyone. I think what concerns me is that we often tend to underestimate how much religion matters to us. And like I said, I think this is part of this life cycle question, that we are getting married at a point where we think religion doesn't matter to us, and then later in life, some aspects of it may start to. And I think that feels to some partners like there's a bait and switch going on.
Yeah.
Not that I think anyone is purposely misrepresenting themselves, but that, you know, you need to sort of take this hard look and say, look, okay, maybe I'm 28 now and I don't go to church regularly, but if I had to imagine my life in the future with children and the way I want to raise my family, oh, yes, I did go to church every week when I was growing up, and I kind of want that for my kids, too. I want that community. I want to send them to a Catholic school. Like, all of these things that I think you have to just, you know, try to picture a little bit more the possibility that you're at a point in your life where religion may not be important, but also leave open the sense that it may become more important as you get older. So that's where I stand on the question. I don't think anyone is saying you must make religion this important part of your life. I just want people to be realistic about how important it is.
Mm-hmm.
And would you say it becomes more important as a couple grows older, or in older couples, the whole spiritual life?
You know, I think it's really a more of an individual question. I mean, I certainly met couples, like I said, for whom religion wasn't important for either person, and then as they grew older, they wanted to spend more time, you know, kind of seeking. You know, they would go take adult education classes at their religious institution. They would be more curious about spiritual matters, and maybe it was because, you know, death felt more imminent, or maybe it was for some other reason. Maybe it's just, you know, when people get older, after their kids have left home, people feel like they have more time to think about these questions and to explore them more in depth. But for whatever reason, I think that's not uncommon.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with the author of a New York Times Book Review Editor's Pick, Till Faith Do Us Part, How Interfaith Marriage is Transforming America, Ms. Naomi Schaefer Riley. Naomi, please tell us what you're up to and how we can find you.
We'll have a website, naomiriley.com. It's R-I-L-E-Y, and I write a couple times a week about different issues, including marriage and religion there. And I'm working now, actually, on a book about parenting and technology. So I'll keep you posted on that, because I think that affects a lot of relationships.
Yes.
Technology, you mean.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
We talked about that once in terms of protocol when you're sitting next to your partner, being on your phone, riding in the car on your phone, that sort of thing. I think most couples these days, when one partner, at least one partner, owns a smartphone, has to deal with that. What religions seem most compatible with one another, if there are any?
Well, I guess a lot of the couples I ended up interviewing, and I think this is a little bit anecdotal, but I ended up interviewing a lot of marriages between Jews and Catholics, and they actually would say to me that they felt, from a cultural perspective, like that their family culture had a lot in common. You know, whether it was kind of just being loud and boisterous, or kind of a similar understanding of the role of family, they felt like those two things kind of fit together well. But I think it also depends on kind of your religious community, you know, how welcoming they are to people of other faiths. And I was interested, you know, across the board, you know, 3/4 of people that I surveyed said they felt their religious congregation was very welcoming to interfaith couples. So I think that also tells you something about, you know, the kind of changing world that we live in.
And even though interfaith marriages are increasing, is conversion increasing also, or decreasing?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, what researchers call religion switching is definitely on the rise in America. You see a lot of that, and some of that has nothing to do with marriage. Some of it is just people who are kind of seeking what they think is the right faith, and they will switch, you know, maybe more than once during their lives to a different faith.
Right.
But I think in terms of marriages, one of the things that interested me was when I looked at people who were married to someone of the same faith, about half of those people said they started off as being different faiths. So I think what you see there is that being in a marriage to someone of another faith often does encourage conversion, or certainly a kind of seeking. And I think our partners can have a great deal of influence over our religious beliefs and practices over time.
Yeah, and I did hear a story once about a guy who, he was Muslim, his wife was Christian, and he actually converted to Christianity out of the way he saw his wife live her life and handle situations. Mm-hmm. He said they had obviously a pretty good degree of flexibility in the relationship. He said she never tried to convert him, but mm-hmm. there were definitely circumstances and situations that she was in, and he watched her work her way through spiritually, or with the benefit of her spiritual foundation, and he was just so impressed by it that he he crossed over, so to speak.
Yeah, I think, you know, marriage really gives you this uniquely intimate understanding of how this other faith works. And especially, you know, a lot of people really participated in raising their children in another faith, and then they felt so welcomed by that community or so interested in what they were doing that they then explored conversion for themselves.
Okay.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we've been talking with the author of a New York Times book review, Editor's Pick, Till Faith Do Us Part, How Interfaith Marriage is Transforming America. She is Naomi Schaefer Riley. Naomi, anything you want to round out with?
No, I mean, I think I would emphasize in talking about this subject that it's interfaith marriage is a mixed blessing. I mean, I think on the one hand, it really tells you what increasingly tolerant society that we have, that there is all this crossing over that can happen between people of different communities. But on the other hand, it really does, I think, present challenges for individuals and couples and families. And there's nothing wrong with sort of pointing out those challenges. There's nothing, you know, bigoted about saying that this can be a difficult bridge to make. And I think we need to be, you know, honest with ourselves about trying to do that.
Along today's journey, we've discussed tips on entering an interfaith marriage, tips on raising children within an interfaith marriage, and religions that may very well be more compatible together than others. Thank you to my co-host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer, and thank you to my guests, Naomi Schaefer Riley. You've been great.
Thank you so much.
I hope you've had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr., that's M-R, Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us. If you're listening via iTunes, make sure you subscribe, so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.